This is BizTech Talk with Dan Kelton. Today, the topic is Patents 101, Defense, Offense, or License. This is relating to the topic of innovation, which I've been plowing into as much as I can over the last about 9 months or so. I've been interviewing people on all sorts of things, from mind mapping techniques, 3 or 4 interviews on that front, to things like trees, the Russian theory of inventive problem solving, which has been around for 50, 60 years, and still most people don't know anything about that, which I think is a shame, so I keep coming back to that. Today, I'm talking to David Nason, who is somebody I found, once again, through LinkedIn, which is, again, anybody who thinks that LinkedIn or social networking in general is something that's just for the kids or whatever it is that you think it is, I found it to be a tremendous resource in finding extremely interesting people on pretty much any topic you can imagine, which is great for me because I'm interested in so many different things. Take a look and make sure that you're on there so that other people can find you as well. I've had some fantastic conversations through LinkedIn one way or another. What caught my eye with David is that his profile listed a number of patents that he had been involved in. And since I have never even authored a patent application yet, I talk about innovation and invention and things like that. I thought, you know, I might as well find out from somebody who has actually done this rather than from an academic standpoint and read lots of books, which I would normally do. Let's talk to somebody who has actually done this and how did he get involved in it and what is involved in it and why should anybody care? And so that's the sort of the general context around that. Some background on David. His personal website, you can find out more about his background, is www.nason.net, and that's nason.net/David. We'll take you to the highlights of his background. He was previously with Medius Corporation, Chief Technology Officer, and also Chief Technology Officer and Chief Scientist at Excise Corporation, and a lot of other areas. And again, the reason why I stumbled onto him was from the patent angle. He's author and inventor on more than 50 patent applications, and to date, 23 U.S. patents have been granted, 9 international patents, and there are many others that are pending. So he's got a bit of background in this. The reason why I chose the title of Patents 101, Defense, Offense, or License was, I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV or on the web, and I don't have an engineering background per se. So most people that I run to also do not have that background. So let's start at the very beginning and assume that people don't know much of anything about this and see if we can help contribute to people's understanding of what is it about patents that makes the world work and how do you defend them and why do you even care about them. So with that said, David, thanks so much for your time. I gave a little bit of your official background. Can you tell me, now, how far back does it go that when you first got into either inventing or actually doing patents, and we'll take it from there?
Thanks, Dan. My pleasure to be here. That's a kind of a two-edged question. Thinking about inventing is actually what got me into the patent side of the business in the first place. I realized that I had come up with a number of those inventions or thoughts that so many people have in their lifetime, you know, different ways to do things that make sense to you in your lifestyle, and never followed up on them, and found many years later that others were following up on them, writing patents or creating inventions and making money on things that, again, you'd thought of years ago.
Okay.
That had always put patenting or patent applications in the back of my mind. Then when I formed a company with some partners, Excise Corporation, mm-hmm. over a brand new invention, over a new technology, and our CEO was a well-known patent attorney, a well-known litigator in the area of intellectual property, I started paying attention to what he had done in his past, started doing some serious research into how patents were used, as you put it, both offensively and defensively, mm-hmm. and through the licensing mechanism, and started looking at creating my own patent strategy. A large number of patents that we filed at that company, and of course every company I've been with since then, are all based on the knowledge and the understanding of the area that I picked up from Bob, our CEO at the time.
Okay. And so how far back does that extend in number of years?
We're talking about 1997, I guess.
From what little I know about the volume of patents that people tend to create, I think being on over 50 patent applications in a roughly 10-year time span, that's pretty darn good.
Fast fingers.
Well, so before we get too far into talking about the ins and outs of patents, could you give a little definition of what is a patent? Why do you want to create them?
Well, we're talking to a large degree the technology sector, although certainly patents spread far and wide beyond that. But in my background, it's technology inventions, whether it's a hardware piece or a software piece. Patents aren't copyrights or trademarks. And that's one of the biggest misconceptions that people have is that I wrote it, I copyrighted it, therefore no one else can duplicate it. Right. That's not true. It is, in fact, very different than a copyright or a trademark. A copyright just is a protection of a work of authorship, you know, something you wrote, a piece of music, something you drew, and that sort of thing. And all that means is somebody can't duplicate it exactly as you did it. Somebody can't take what you did and replicate it somewhere else.
Okay.
A patent, on the other hand, is a property right. It is an invention that you created, whether it's a piece of hardware or it's a piece of software or it's a process. It gives you the exclusive right to keep anyone else from making it, using it, selling it without your permission. And that includes even importing it into the United States, assuming we're talking about a U.S. patent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good usually for 20 years.
Hmm.
So okay. The reason that somebody wants a patent, as I said earlier, threefold. One, offensively, you want to stop somebody else that's in your space from going in a direction that you don't want them to go. They haven't already patented it. It is patentable. You can do an offensive strategy to prevent them from going into a space that you want to own all by yourself by patenting and patenting widely around the area. You can patent defensively, which is to say you want to go into a new space. You want to create a patent and create a technology that you want to own and not allow anyone else in that space. You effectively want to be a monopoly.
Okay.
That's patent. The patent is a monopoly in a specific area.
Mm-hmm.
Or thirdly, as you said in your title, a great title, licensing. A lot of people write patents because they're protecting something. They don't want anyone else in that space. But a significant use of patents in this day and age is for licensing. You do want to turn it into a mechanism of income. You have an idea. You have a great idea. You don't want to be the inventor of the idea and the manufacturer of the idea. Fine. You invent it. You get a patent on it, and you license it to someone else or broadly to a number of other people.
I think, and I haven't scientifically tested this, but I think most people's conception of a patent is more of, I guess, the offensive standpoint, trying to carve out a space that you're already in and keep people from kind of chewing away at your borders. And the license side, all of the work that I've done has been with software companies. People so often get kind of siphoned down into just thinking how to reduce cost rather than how to increase revenues, and this the idea of looking at it as a way that you could get other people to do the work of selling or manufacturing or distributing or whatever it happens to be is something I don't think quite comes naturally to people, but maybe that's just my perception.
I agree.
Well, so from the bare bones of patents, you're not a lawyer, but it does help that the early days of your career there that you had a CEO who was a lawyer. Are there some tidbits we can drop in to again help break down what is the world of creating a patent and doing a patent application as a first step? What is it you need to mentally conceive of when you want to pursue doing any sort of patent work? Is it upfront research? How does that work out?
Well, there's really two sides to that as well. There's the idea that anyone that writes or software or anyone that comes up with an invention or has an idea really needs to look into whether or not that's already owned, whether or not it's already been patented. Anyone that writes software or invents a technology is a fool not to look into the ownership of the licensing before they get too far down the road. And the large number of companies we all know have gotten into that.
Yeah.
So early research, early patent search is very important, whether it's for the intention of patenting or for the intention of being careful and safe. Patent searching is very easy. Anyone can search for a patent. Anyone can search the patent libraries. There's the USPTO government website, which lists all issued patents and all published patent applications from the last 20 years.
Okay.
It's a very good site, very easy to search, has a very usable and user-friendly search mechanism. It can be as creatively defined as you want or as simple keyword-oriented as you want. There are a number of third-party applications, Delphion and so forth, that are subscription-based that you can do searches as well. And the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office also supports a patent search room that gives even more detail than what you can get on the website, as well as a number of patent search libraries around the country. So you can always use those. And, of course, any registered patent attorney or patent agent can do a full patent search as well. It probably costs something in the neighborhood of $600, but they can do a very detailed patent search for anyone that's at that level or anyone that's ready to make that next step.
Okay.
Once you've determined that you have something that's patentable, which, again, can certainly come from nothing more than searching the USPTO website, it's not that difficult to move forward in the direction of a patent. You know, people are scared of the idea, daunted by the complexity of what a patent seems to be.
Right.
But the reality, it's a pretty simple process. And it's made simple by its own complexity. The Patent and Trademark Office insists on I's being dotted and T's being crossed in exactly the right way. And therefore, it is, while legally possible for anyone to walk through the entire patenting process, it is very difficult for someone who is not a patent agent or a patent attorney to do the main interaction with the Patent and Trademark Office. It's not to say it's difficult for them to write the patent. That is to say it's difficult for them to process the patent correctly and accurately.
Gotcha.
Most people, most inventors, will hire a patent attorney or a patent agent. And to differentiate between the two, a patent agent is not an attorney at law. It is a person who has not gone through law school, but has met a set of standards and sat through the Patent and Trademark Office's examinations, the same ones effectively that the patent attorneys take, and can prosecute a patent all the way through the issuance and all the relationship with the Patent and Trademark Office. The substantial difference really is a patent attorney can litigate your patent, that is to say, sue somebody for you, defend your patent in a lawsuit against it, whereas a patent agent can't do that. That's not a reason to not use a patent agent in creating the patent unless you want to create a long-term relationship with somebody.
Sure. Okay.
So you have an idea. You've done all your research. You've done your general search to identify that this is something that you can do. It's not that difficult to come up with an idea and put it down in writing in such a way that you can start the process to generating a patent. And for sake of getting your initial date registered in the patent office, something as simple as, well, let's not say a cocktail napkin, but a paper replication of a cocktail napkin can be submitted to the patent office to lock the date down to give you some priority. And then that wouldn't be the date of your patent, but it would certainly be the date of the conception of the invention. You can file a provisional patent, which is just a good description of your invention. And then you can hit the basic filing fee, keep your costs down, and that sort of thing.
Okay. Now, when you're looking to create the provisional patent or register your initial idea with the Patent and Trademark Office, how fully thought does it have to be? If the ultimate aim is a piece of hardware, an appliance or something, do you have to have a working model? Can it be purely theoretical? How much do you have to put in there?
You have to be able to describe it. It does not have to be a working model. You have to be able to describe and identify how the device will work. If, assuming, as you said, it's a hardware device, you'd have to be able to describe it in enough detail that somebody could build it. And now this is for your original provisional. If you plan to create a utility patent, which is a basic patent, an application for a device or a process, in order to file a utility patent application, your initial provisional, if you have one, has to describe in the same level of detail as your utility patent would how to do it. You can go off and add additional pieces to your provisional, but essentially, by the time you file your utility patent, it can't contain anything in it that wasn't already described in your set of provisionals.
And in the case of software, do you have to have code in place, or again, does it have to just be theoretically well enough described that it could be built by, assuming you have the resources in place?
The latter. Again, it's the definition that the Patent and Trademark Office uses is someone who is skilled in the art. So theoretically, that means someone who's about as good as you at the engineering side or the development side of whatever it is that you're doing. If someone skilled in the art could read your description and invent your invention, you have described it in enough detail.
Okay. It is curious. It sounds like there's both a lot more to it than most people would think and also a lot less. It's getting the definitions together in your head, understanding whether you want to use a patent attorney or a patent agent, or perhaps do it yourself, but maybe in the early iterations you don't want to do that and totally swim alone?
Well, and certainly you can do a combination. Most of the patents that I have issued to date have been written in combination, both myself and collaborators and patent attorneys or patent agents. And literally, you can start writing completely yourself if you have a good idea of how to do it. Do all of the initial disclosure, that is the part that discloses how to create the invention,
mm-hmm.
and hand that off to a patent attorney to clean it up, put it together, make sure that there's nothing missing, and file it.
Well, so why don't we talk about a real example then just hinting at little bits and pieces. Can you talk about maybe one of your early patents and the sort of process that you went through to do the initial work and actually, you know, run it through the system and perhaps on out to, you know, what was the end result of that?
Sure. One of the patents that I created, which was for a secondary display space on a standard PC, was an idea. It was a new technology that had been created by in order to spin off a company, actually. And the idea was certainly worthy of patenting. There was no prior art to speak of. There was no invention already patented. There was no one else doing the same technology, and certainly not in the same way, using the same mechanism and process.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quickly identified as being patentable. It met the basic criteria for a patent, which is that it has to be usable. You have to define a patent as useful. Your invention, has to be defined as being useful. In a practical sense, that means you have to be able to say, and this is what you would do with it, and have that make sense to the patent examiner. Because if you invent something that either can never be built or no one would ever want it, then you can't get a patent on it. For all the reasons that make sense.
As long as one person finds use in it.
I guess that's true. That one person being the examiner, usually.
Right.
Right. The patent has to be novel. That is to say, it has to be, you know, something that wasn't known or wasn't used before you file. That's the thing. New, unique, whatever. And it has to be non-obvious because, you know, we can all come up with things that no one's ever patented before, but they've never patented it before because it's been around for so long or obvious for so long that it doesn't make any sense to the examiner that you would patent. Or secondly, that it's an obvious use of something else that was patented. You can patent something that's based on another invention, of course, that was done in the past. If it is a new use for it or an improvement on it, and if the improvement itself is, as we said earlier, useful, novel, and non-obvious. And in that case, in that context, it has to be the case that the implementation of it in this form would be not obvious to anyone else schooled in the art, as it's said again. Once you get to that point that you've decided that this thing, and in this case, this invention was useful, we defined a use for it, it was novel, no one had ever done it before, it was not known that it could be done, and it was non-obvious in that it was, although it did work off existing display technologies, there was already such a thing as a CRT display or an LCD display, in those cases, it was non-obvious. So having identified it as being patentable, having identified it as having not already been done by anybody, which is not just to say it's patented, because you cannot be patented if it has ever been published. Somebody has said, this is how you do it, and wrote it up in a trade magazine or in Time magazine or anything else. If it has been published, then it is already blocked. It's effectively considered prior art. Again, once I had made that determination, it was something to sit down and start writing about. So I started writing a disclosure. I wrote a disclosure. This wasn't my first application, so I knew how to do it. I wrote a disclosure that described the background of the invention, why there was a value to this, what the current state of the art was, and why this was an improvement on the state of the art, what it could be used for, and then the disclosure that says, this is how you do it. So somebody that understood enough about the technology that was schooled in the art could sit down and read my patent disclosure and say, oh, that's how we did it, and replicate it. Now, I created a provisional, so I didn't need any claims. It was a quick and easy patent application, and sent it to our patent attorneys. They went through it. We made a couple of minor changes to it. I had already created the necessary set of drawings. They made sure it was all in the right form, which is to say those nailed. It's a numbered form. You know, your lines are numbered. It has to fit a certain description of what the Patent and Trademark Office wants to receive. Again, they don't want cocktail napkins. They want it to look, every patent application has to look roughly the same, the correct columns and so forth.
Right.
They put that together, filed it, and I continued work on the invention. What I get out of that is I have a filing date, which means anything I do subsequent to that invention in terms of the application for a patent is based on that date. This is the date at which the patent is protected. Anyone that files a patent or creates an invention subsequent to this date is infringing on my patent, or in this case, my pending patent. Once you file a provisional application, you are patent pending. You can disclose what you've got now as being patent pending. You have 1 year to create a utility patent, a utility application that takes advantage of that provisional patent, or you just let the provisional patent die. So you have a reason for that, which could be, for example, you substantially change the invention, including how you do it, which means your old disclosure is no good anymore, and you'd have to redo that. Now you're, although there are ways to work around that, a continuation application, for example. Subsequently, I filed a utility application that went through the patent office, and we've also filed continuation in parts on that. That is to say, additional sets of claims, additional disclosures that went with those additional sets of claims. In that particular case that I'm referring to, the patent issued, on top of which it issued in a first office action, which is to say that the examiner went through it and had no questions or reasons to decline the patent application. Mm-hmm. Often when an examiner looks at an application, he'll say, I don't think this claim should go through, or I don't think that claim should be allowed, and he'll return it to your attorneys, to the inventor. The inventor subsequently responds to it, asks for a change, argues with the examiner as to how he's incorrect, or just excises that claim and resubmits based on that, and then you know, second office action, third action, and it goes forward from that. Having a patent issue with a first office action is fairly rare, as I understand it, and I've had several, and one could attribute that to well-written or maybe well-edited, if I wanted to give the benefit to the attorneys, but to well-done patent applications in the first place. And the fact that it was, in these cases, a wide open technology field, that there was very little that could be disputed with regard to prior art or other technologies.
In this case, was this your second patent application, or how far were you into being experienced?
The one I just described was my second.
Okay. So it sounds like you learned quite a bit the first time around.
Well, actually, the first time around, I filed a patent application with a company that was here in Seattle. And they were a great group of guys, particularly the individual I worked with. I learned a lot from him. He's a very smart guy. And this is actually before we spun off the technology, and therefore before I met our new CEO, before he became our new CEO. And therefore, it was under working with him and all the lessons learned, positive and negative, from the first experience that made the second that much smoother.
Let's return again to sort of a beginner mindset. I think we've got some great stuff here that will help people to understand how to go about it, why they want to do it, the three reasons, offense, defense, or license. If you were to recommend, aside from getting employed by somebody that has a CEO that's a patent attorney or has background in that, that might be hard to do. So any other starting points that you think we could point people to?
Well, I'll tell you, the Patent and Trademark Office, www.uspto.gov, has a huge amount of information on the patent process, on what you have to do, how it has to be done, and even to some degree why you would choose to do it. There's a number of books. I guess I've never actually seen a Writing a Patent for Dummies book. There's an idea out there for somebody, I suppose. There are a number of websites that discuss why to patent or why there's a value in patent. Some of them are very specific to the industry area. Somebody who's into biotech and is interested in writing a patent and why. Sometimes the reasons for patenting in the biotech arena are very different than in any other, because they're trying to make the step from research to manufacture, and they have to find a way not only to protect what they invented during the research phase, but to own it for a substantial enough time to pay back the amount of money that was expended in the research phase.
Right.
And the cost of the manufacturer sometimes, too. Whereas in tech research, it's generally substantially lower cost to entry. And what you're doing is more protecting to own your market or protecting to own your licensing. similar to a biotech arena in that regard, but not necessarily being forced to recoup costs, but rather going forward.
Right, it's part of the business model rather than on the revenue side rather than the cost side.
Right. And, you know, when it comes down to determining whether or not you have something to go with, the Patent and Trademark Office maintains a registry of registered patent attorneys and patent agents. And certainly any attorney should come from that list. And actually, I had somebody ask me just a few days ago how you would determine whether the person you're talking to is the right patent attorney or not. And again, since the USPTO does license or register attorneys, and they claim a substantial due diligence in determining that somebody is a good patent and trademark attorney. They can't be just a law student. It's not just an individual that got a law degree and said, I think I'm going to do patents. They
right.
go through a process. They have to take that bar. But on top of that, they have to have a degree in a technology or science-related field prior to having been an attorney. I should be careful. It might not be prior, but they have to have a science or technology degree as well.
Okay.
And that is to assure that you not only have a patent attorney who understands how to do the patent, but they have a reasonable chance of understanding what it is you are trying to patent and therefore can talk about it cogently with the inventor.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. I could certainly see having an attorney that has some experience in especially an extremely technical field. That would be an awfully good idea rather than just pick up Dolly, 1-800 patent lawyer and see who you get.
Right. Subsequently, once you find through whatever mechanism that you want an attorney that you're interested in, it is actually the case that as you're doing a patent search, you can search for patents based on the attorney or the agent.
Hmm.
So if you were interested in a particular individual, or you found an individual in your Yellow Pages or local to your town or whatever that you thought might be a good person or a recommendation from your next-door neighbor, it's pretty easy to search out what patents have been issued or what applications are currently published
mm-hmm.
that have been handled by that individual.
Okay. You have to worry about things like conflict of interest then? You don't necessarily want to work with the patent attorney who knows all about this area because there might be, even though there are non-disclosure and client attorney privilege and all, maybe not the best idea to find the guy who seems to be hyper-focused on your area.
Well, that's arguable in both directions. Certainly you might think about, if you were writing something and his this particular attorney had filed a substantial number of patents for the company that you've already identified as your main competition. But that attorney should tell you that up front, too.
Right.
So you might think about that. But on the other hand, if you're creating an invention in a particular area and the attorney that you are considering has a substantial number of patents somewhere in that particular area and the patents have issued, then you have a good feeling that this person totally understands that particular area and can, in fact, either steer you the right path to get your patent issued or prevent you from losing the money on a losing proposition.
Right. That paints a nice starting picture, at least and maybe more than a starting picture, of all the definitions that we've gone through on the various stages of patents, doing the research. Having been in the search space for 13 years or so now, searching patents is probably a little easier than many other sorts of information services, just due to the nature that it is kind of a constrained universe that you're searching into.
It's not the case that you can self-issue. Your patents come from the government. From one government to another, they have to come from a government agency. That does make them a lot more searchable.
Yeah, it might not be pretty, but at least you can get there.
That's right. Now, again, though, you have to search for more than just patents, but it is a very constrained universe, as you said. You're searching for existing patents, you're searching for published patent applications, and you're searching for publications. That's really all you have to search to try to do a diligent search for prior art is through all of the various publications. Again, everything that has been printed in the last 15 years is online somewhere.
Right. Yeah, just finding it. But at least this gives people some good starting points. And if you really want to do an exhaustive search, well, then you can hire somebody, a patent agent or attorney, and do a bit more work.
It's like every other job. The more you put into it, the more footwork you put into it up front, the less it costs you and the less heartache down the road.
I might be more likely to do this sort of work myself rather than, for example, re-roof my house. feels like more risk for me in doing that. I think this is a great place to stop. There's a lot, and obviously you're very experienced in this. There's a whole huge universe that we could talk about, more information on how you've worked through this. Try not to completely blow people's heads off their shoulders when I get into a subject like this. So let's leave the door open. We'll see if maybe it's worth us getting together in a month or two or something like that and hit it again. But I think this is a great introduction. So let me wrap up. Again, thanks for your time. It was fantastic talking to you today and previously, and I hope we can stay in touch on this and see what's going on here. The title for today was Patents 101, Defense, Offense, or License. I was speaking with David Mason. His personal website, you can find out more about his biography and background there, is at www.nason.net/David. We'll lead you directly there. You're listening to BizTech Talk. The blog is at www.biztechtalk.com. I'm Dan Kelfin. I've done 30, 40 or so interviews at this point on lots of topics. So if you found this interesting, please hop on back to the blog and see what else I've been talking about and with who I've been talking to. If you have any feedback for me, I do have a call-in line that is at 781-268-0716. I'd love to hear from you. Hear any stories that you have around patents, innovation, inventing, or any of the other topics that we've hit today in other sessions. So feel free to call in and leave me a message, and we'll have a conversation there. Of course, you can hop onto the blog and either comment directly or track back from your own blog as you like. Again, David, it was fantastic talking to you, and I'd love to stay in touch.
Thanks, Dan. It was my pleasure, and as you gathered, I'm perfectly willing to talk about this subject as long as it takes.
Okay. Great. Thanks so much.